Yes, and if he is smart, that car will be a Ford Focus. The Ford Focus has been named the greatest car of the past 25 years. Dave Moore will join us to give us his opinion on this. What's your opinion on that?
I'm just wondering how many Ford Focus owners, if offered an Aston Martin or an Alfa Romeo, would say, no, you're all good.
You're making an unassailable point.
It's what I do.
I don't know what you two drive, but the reason why the Ford Focus has been named as the greatest car of the last 25 years is because it redefined what customers should expect from an affordable hatchback. And even today, says Auto Express magazine, it is a very comfortable car. Is that a sufficient criterion? It redefined what you'd expect from a hatchback?
It's got four wheels and an engine. What did it redefine exactly?
You think, what about the cars that were first with, you know, ABS or stability control or whatever?
Yeah.
Anyway.
I'm at a loss.
And May doesn't want to.
I don't know what a Ford Focus is. My car is grey. Sorry.
May's driving. I think it's been proven that grey cars are the greatest cars also.
The greatest colour of the last 25 years.
Can I just say, the thing that pops out to me here is that you're looking down the list and you've got cars like the Veyron and the Charisma, spelled with no H, or the Avantime. And it's got to the point where my wife's going to kill me for saying this, but I'll tell the story anyway. About a year ago, Debbie and I were in the car, and for some reason we'd been noticing some of these sitting in traffic, these ridiculous names, and we were remarking upon them. And she said, "Look at that thing in front of us. What the hell's a Falloon?"
Thank you. Fairfax.
She is blonde, yes.
Fairfax Motoring Editor Dave Moore joining us. Good afternoon, sir.
How are you?
I'm very well.
When you're looking at some of these choices,
yes,
you've got to assume the car will actually get to where you're going, which is probably more likely in the Focus than some of the other cars mentioned.
What, like the Bugatti Veyron?
Well, of course, you're not going to go far in a tank, are you? And while it's terrifically exciting to drive, I couldn't imagine living with one.
No, but there are some cars here, aren't there, that would seem very impressive nevertheless. The Aston Martin DB9 and the Nissan GTR and even the Volkswagen Golf, that makes the list but doesn't beat the Ford Focus.
Well, the fact is that if you look at the detail of the research, the Focus won that prize, not all Focuses. And the Focus one, when it came out, was absolutely outrageous. Reset the parameters for ride, handling, equipment levels, and pride of ownership even. People really got attached to them, and a very good car it was. The Series 2 and the Series 3 have carried that along, but they're not possibly as good compared to others as that first Focus One was.
Although, so this is a fair enough decision?
Hmm.
Okay, in your view?
I think it's a very sensible choice.
Okay.
I mean, for instance, the nicest house to live in isn't Buckingham Palace, is it? You'd certainly think of something realistic. It's a realistic car, and I think Auto Express's definition was pretty close. It's an affordable, achievable car. It's got all the safety kit, for instance, that you could only get on an S-Class Benz 5 or 6 years ago.
All right. Yeah, okay. So you're arguing
very well with trickle down, I must say.
You're arguing persuasively and also, as usual, in an educated manner. Can I ask you about the worst cars that they also put in there? What is wrong with the PT Cruiser? Do you really
excuse me laughing at that. Well, just look at it.
Thank you. They've always looked fairly stylish, haven't they, the Chrysler PT Cruiser?
The car it was trying to mimic was stylish, but it didn't quite manage it. And when I wrote the road test about the car, being a four-cylinder, a very wheezy four-cylinder engine in a car that, the car of which it mimicked was a big V8, I called it a knot rod.
A knot rod.
And that's exactly it. It's actually, I liken it to a Morris Minor Traveller.
Oh.
And I'd have the Traveller. And bearing in mind 40 years between the designs, I think the Morris is more advanced.
It's a harsh assessment. What about Mei Chen's criterion for the colour grey?
It's a very safe colour because you're buying the car for the next buyer. So you buy the colours you really like, you're going to lose value when you change the car. So silver, which is grey, is probably the most, if I look out of my window here in the office, the most common car colour is silver, and Japanese racing white.
Can I say that I always thought that it was nurture over nature. And so when I had a little boy, I thought, look, it's just a matter of socialising him and giving him dolls as well as cars. But I soon realised, having come from a family of four girls, that actually boys are different from girls. I caught him in the garage at the age of 1.5, stroking the tyres of my car. He has never been interested in dolls. He has always wanted to go brum, brum. So I find this very interesting because, you see, I'm surrounded by all these blokes who are talking about things I have no idea about. And all I can say is my corporate car is grey.
And you have no idea what brand it is?
It's a Lexus, I think.
Okay.
So you've got a Toyota. Very good.
She's got a Toyota.
Well, I am actually feeling quite proud of myself. My very first ever car was a Volkswagen Golf.
How did you manage that?
I bought it used from a mate.
It was dead cheap. Fancy first car.
Diesel engine Mark 1 Golf. And I bought it cheap and it was lovely. I called it the Baron because it was German and it was red. And it was my favourite car ever. And it was written off when some bloke drove into the back of me 6 months later.
Can I ask you?
They were a lovely, lovely looking car, the Series 1 Golf.
Oh, I miss it terribly.
What was your first car, Dave Moore, just out of interest before you go?
Standard 8.
Oh, magnificent.
I won't tell you how I knew, but you know a 2-2 bullet will go right through and out the other side?
Dave Moore. I'm sure that's apocryphal. 19 minutes to 5 o'clock on the panel. Private schools, that discussion. Shortly, the value of what's on the minds of our panellists. Steve?
Well, I've been thinking about cold recently. I know spring has officially sproined, apparently. And for those of us fortunate to be up in the top end of the North Island today, it's been absolutely gorgeous. But it's been cold lately, and I've been following a discussion in a group that I read on Facebook about rental houses that are being rented out with no heating, no insulation, no provision whatsoever for the elements during the typically cold and damp winters that we tend to get here in New Zealand. And I find myself wondering why we're allowing this state of affairs to continue. Renters obviously aren't in a position to start equipping houses with, say, heat pumps or insulation or the like. You know, yeah. The structural improvements that it's not their place to make. And yet landlords seem to be very, very unwilling to invest the money to do so, which means that people who aren't in a position, and these numbers are going to grow very shortly, aren't in a position to buy their own houses, are stuck living in houses which are, frankly, unhealthy to live in, yeah, given our climate. So I find myself wondering, is it time to bring in some sort of legislation which requires rented properties to meet a certain level of climatic suitability? If we do this, I think, first of all, we're going to see an enormous saving in healthcare, because we've got a lot of people who aren't going to be getting the respiratory diseases that are endemic in this country as a result of this. We're also going to see, as a knock-on effect, there's going to be plenty of landlords unwilling to make the investment, and that's fine. That will then presumably see them dumping their houses on the market, which might actually start to see
cheaper house prices.
Exactly. That's going to be a knock-on effect, which could then see some of these people who are currently renting who would like to be buying in a position where the market's been driven down and they can start to afford to buy their own houses. It just strikes me as being, at the moment, a ridiculous situation where people I've spoken to take it as a mark of pride that they haven't lit their wood burner since April, and yet they tell me this between bouts of raspy coughing because they're killing themselves by living in cold, damp houses. I know people who think they're just hardened up because they wear socks and hats to bed. This is crazy.
Would rents go up? That is the other possibility.
That's a potential downside to it, yes. But at the same time, if you've got insulation, you've got well-designed heating, then suddenly you're not paying an arm and a leg in electricity bills every month, yeah, to run your ridiculously inefficient oil-thin heaters.
Okay, so the health of the nation is paramount. Why not enshrine that in the need for insulation and heat pumps, and fewer New Zealanders get sick, they don't overload our healthcare system, etc. Those arguments.
There you go. It took me 3 minutes to say it. It took you 15 seconds.
You should run for Parliament. I'm sure that's a worthy policy.
Steve McCabe. Mei Chen.
I've been thinking about my treasure chest. And the reason is because I'm aware of the fact that over half my life is over. So in this little treasure chest,
May,
I am putting in there all the things that I would like to pass on to my family. And so this is part two of willtolive.co.nz. And so we're just getting it up now. And you can have this little treasure chest. So I've been putting stuff away in mine. Jim, I've been thinking about the sorts of things that I treasure and would want to pass on if I was not able to do that personally. So that's been interesting. I've been also astounded at the number of people that don't have wills. Astounded. Do you have a will, Jim? Is it up to date?
No, I do. Well, it's not that up to date, but it's functional. I think it's functional.
Yes.
Okay, so you talked about willtolive.co.nz last time, just for the benefit of people who weren't here last time. Just explain it again.
Yeah, it's a website which allows you very simply to make wills, because 80% of people don't need lawyers. I mean, they don't have that much. But the difficulty is that if you don't plan, then what happens is when you die intestate, and of course all these other rules kick in. Mm. And as a consequence of that, your family is often left to try and figure out what it was you were intending. And the good thing I find is that when people plan to die, because it's going to happen to us all, then actually it forces you to come to grips with the fact that you have a limited time period, and that is very clarifying. So many people say to me, oh, I don't know what to do with myself, I don't know what to decide. Well, ask yourself, if you were going to die in a year, I'm sure it will clarify precisely what you should and shouldn't be doing.
Yeah.
And so it's a good exercise for me all the time. When I'm tempted to come home after a difficult day and be ratty, I just say to myself, if my family was not here, I would be a sad person. So it's the power of death, really, to make you really live your life the way that you should.
Okay, so it's got two important benefits. A, you've got a tidy will, and B, you think about your life.
Yes, because
realistic terms.
Well, when you deal with people in death situations, as I do, it's a very stressful time, as you know, Jim. They've already got coping with grief, but then, you know, if the estate is not tidy, and then on top of that there's no savings for funerals, it just causes additional pain. And then, of course, for lawyers, usually we turn up when the family's fighting about the estate, and that, of course, causes enormous grief. And for me, it's meant that I've had to sit round tables with numerous other lawyers and representing each member of the family, fighting it out. Really unpleasant.
May Chen. Thank you, May. May Chen on the panel. Steve McCabe. Linda Reid joining us shortly. Slate magazine, which is a big online magazine, as many of you will know, is running a piece which has attracted a lot of attention internationally, partly because of the headline, which reads, "If you send your kid to private school, you are a bad person." And the arguments in this piece, which you can read for yourself, of course, against private schools, pretty much as you'd expect. First, a child's home situation is the most important factor in predicting life success, so private schools are a waste of money. Secondly, in escaping shoddy public education, you are exacerbating the shoddy quality of public education. So it then becomes a moral issue. Instead, you should enrol your child in the local school and work to make that school better, and then schools will improve. Now, before we hear Linda's point of view on this, and she, of course, is the principal of St Cuthbert's College in Auckland, what do you think about this argument?
Well, I have a very strong view about this. I went through state schools throughout. My parents didn't have the resources to send us anywhere else. And look, I'm not saying that it was a bad education, but I had a couple of frustrations. The first thing was that most people said, oh, you guys will be fine, so we're going to spend all of our efforts on students that aren't doing so well. So as a consequence of that, I did a lot of my own learning throughout my time there. And it was also in an environment where there wasn't necessarily a great deal of support of people who really wanted to work hard and excel. So I also have to say that I tried very hard with my own family to put them through state schools. I thought we needed to support the public school system, but then I discovered that they couldn't read, write or count. So at that point I decided that we shouldn't be I needed to take my family out and put them into private school. That's what I did. And I have to say two things changed. First of all, my child did learn to read, write and count. And secondly, the whole attitude was very different. The principal met my child and said, do you really want to be here? I don't mind if you're not at the top of the class, but I just want to know that you will try as hard as you can. And I love the attitude, that's all. And I'm not saying that is the way for everybody, and I'm not saying that's every private school. I think there are lots of downsides as well, but I think to say that all people who send their kids off to private school are bad, well, you know, I don't agree.
I think we need to look at a certain class of people within that category who do send their children to public school. And I'm going to call out the Prime Minister as a classic example. This is the man who ultimately should take responsibility for the state of the nation's schools. He's not willing to send his child to one of them. And so you have to wonder, why not? Surely he then needs to be looking at why he's not sending his child to a state school. What's the shortfall? And this is a man who will be sending his child to schools, presumably in the very top decile range. And yet they're not good enough for his kids. So certainly if you look down the bottom end where I work, down in the Deso 1 and 2 schools, then we've got big problems. Our schools are not all they need to be. We don't have the funding. We absolutely do not have sufficient funding. We don't have the resources that we need. And we do end up with children who are struggling with their reading and their writing, the most fundamental skills beyond which nothing else can develop without those skills. Kids are coming to me who's at 14 can't meaningfully read or write. And it's because they've been going through schools which aren't resourced sufficiently to provide for them. And one of the reasons they're not sufficiently resourced is because we have a system, which we've talked about on the panel before, where parents are expected to provide top-up contributions because the schools are inherently underfunded. Mm. And at the richer schools, at the higher decile schools, parents can provide enough of a contribution that when you aggregate that together, the schools can then cobble together sufficient funds to run the school adequately. In the lower decile schools, by very definition, the parents don't have those resources to then to pass on to the schools, and the schools are working day-to-day, hand-to-mouth. And
okay, so that is not a problem you can solve, am I inferring correctly, by simply making a decision to support the local school?
No, I think we have to admit that the local school often isn't good enough, and it's not the fault of the teachers or the management. It's largely the fault of the system, which doesn't enable the schools to function any better.
Linda Reid is joining us, Principal of St Cuthbert's College in Auckland. Good afternoon, Linda.
Hi, Jim. How are you? Hi, panel.
You've probably heard the accusation before that is in Slate magazine, although the headline's pretty bald. If you send your kid to private school, you're a bad person. Is there any merit in that argument at all, that you should, in fact, concentrate your efforts as a parent in making public schools better?
I think if you're taking an economic perspective, and the blogger does. I mean, she also says she's just judgmental, and I think that's true too. And think about what your panelist has just said. In a way, I believe, and it's not the primary motivation for most parents, but in a way, if you send your child to a private school, you are rendering public good, in that there is a saving to the state of around $200 million a year, because some parents choose to exercise the right they have to have their child educated independently. And in fact, independent schools, ISNZ members, contribute about $12 million in GST above and beyond what is received in grants. So the state is what we call a net fiscal beneficiary of parents opting to exercise that choice. Now, you can extend that argument, I guess, to say that that allows money to be spent within the existing students at state schools, and the state would have to spread that provision more thinly if they were educating all New Zealand school-aged children.
Yes, I know there's an economic argument for private schools, you know, to gainsay the regular accusation that, you know, they are an economic drain. So I know that there's that aspect of it. In terms of moral responsibility, which is what Slate magazine is getting into, Linda, what about that argument that, in fact, you know, we shouldn't avoid the schools in our neighbourhoods because they will simply get worse the more we avoid them?
I guess that's setting an exceptionally high bar for parents, and it's saying, I will put the greater good of the nation ahead of what I see as my child's needs. And those needs can be right across the spectrum of why somebody might go to a private school. I think there is an instinctive and natural human response to do the best that you can for your child, and that may mean selecting a school that meets your kid's interests more closely. I think it's a rare parent who could see it from a completely national perspective, because the logical extension of that argument is that you wouldn't go and buy a house in the decile 10 school catchment, you'd go and buy it somewhere else. And that would be the truly moral step to take. Because, in fact, most people who are going, to be honest, sending their kids to private schools are going to be sending them to decile 8, 9 and 10 schools.
What about the argument, which is, I think, is only touched on briefly in this piece, but you hear it regularly, that, in fact, what is really crucial for children is the home environment rather than what the parents think will be the benefit of a private school. Now, you would know the research on that. How useful is private school education per se, in your view?
I think that there was certainly a dominant view in the 80s that that home environment was all. I think the prevailing view now is that it's a combination of home environment and teacher quality. And I think that is, there's a good deal of research evidence, Hattie et al., that it is teacher quality that really makes the difference. And there is a lot of evidence that suggests, particularly at primary school age, that the impact of having a teacher of low quality can have an influence or an effect of up to 5 years. So teacher quality is the really defining one. And private schools would say that one of the things that we believe define us is that we try to have, just as state schools do, the best possible teachers.
All right. Thank you, Linda Reid. Linda Reid from St Cuthbert's College in Auckland. Just one little line from this piece, which I thought was plaintive. And it says, you want a cohesive educational philosophy. You want creativity, not teaching to the test. You want great outdoor space and small classrooms and personal attention. You know who else wants these things? Everyone. Let's talk about Air New Zealand. Just finally, the flight attendant forced to hand over the Facebook interactions and the bank account information. She's won her battle against Air New Zealand. But nevertheless, she had to hand over the information. Mei Chen, has this set some kind of benchmark for what employers can demand?
Absolutely, because prior to this, employers could use Facebook information they already had. But in this case, they actually requested it. They didn't have it. And the court said, hand it over. Now, in the end, she still won, but that was because her dismissal was unjustified. They said, look, she legitimately took sick leave. But if you look at the court case, it says the explanation for taking sick leave must be tested for veracity. So what they say here is, was the evidence relevant? Well, yes, it was. What she was doing on Facebook, what she was posting that day, so hand it over. So that's pretty extraordinary, because generally when we're on Facebook, she says, having an account, never been on it, but because I'm way too old and haven't had time. But you know, generally when people are on Facebook, one understands that people think that it's very private. You know, there they are communicating to their small group of friends and, yes, okay. And what this shows you is, no, it ain't. The people can ask you, or the court can ask you to hand it over. The employer can ask you to hand it over.
And the bank records.
And the bank records as well. So I think what this says to employees is that just as employers have to act in good faith, they do too. And if you're going to lie, you might get caught.
Yeah, but I mean, even if it's okay to do it, is it okay to do it over one day's sick leave application?
Well, in this case, clearly the overall decision was that it was an unjustified dismissal.
Yeah.
But that is a separate issue from whether or not the employers could actually ask for the information.
Yeah.
The court said, yes, they can ask for the evidence. It is admissible. It is relevant. But nevertheless, in this particular case, I mean, she took it off to look after her sick sister who had a baby, so that was fair enough.
Yeah, it was all legit in the end.
Yeah. But it's the way it's done that kind of concerns me. The employer made the decision to dismiss. They dismissed. It was challenged. And then they said, right, well, we're going to need to back up this decision. We are now going to make a very intrusive request. And no, this Facebook will give you two different ways of posting information. You make it public, you make it private. Presumably, they've trawled through the public stuff and come up with nothing. So now they're asking, it's equivalent to, say, hand over your private handwritten diary. If you'd like, this is information that was written with the assumption of privacy. Bank details, you know, again, they didn't have this information. They're suddenly realizing they're on the back foot. They have to justify their decision. They're now scrambling. That's not the way it's meant to be done.
Yeah, and I mean, the way he's describing it, the way Steve is, May, it's a bit like the private investigator coming up with nothing, so going into the bedroom and taking the diary out of the top drawer. I mean, it's that level of not legality, it was legal, but it's that level of intrusiveness,
well,
isn't it?
Well, it's that retrospective justification and all of the other problems with this dismissal, yes. which resulted in it being being held to be unlawful. But it's interesting that within the confines of this case, there was a particular issue about the evidence.
Yes.
And with respect to the evidence that was sought to be put before the court said the touchstone for admitting evidence is relevance.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is relevant, so hand it over.
So that's what we can expect more of in future, is what
but
you're
don't
saying.
Don't throw sickies.
No.
Well, if you do, don't go on Facebook.
Try and stay well. Mei Chen, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
On the panel, Steve McCabe, you too.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Checkpoint follows, and we are back tomorrow.